this could be the strongest storm to hit the Bering in possibly decades.
The Aleutian and Pribilof Islands brace for a superstorm in the Bering Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the NCAA penalizes the University of Alaska Fairbanks for several infractions.
These infractions were the result of university errors and not due to wrongdoing by any of our student athletes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Aleutian and Pribilof Islands are no strangers to strong winds and rough seas, and that's exactly what they can expect tomorrow when a high-powered storm hits the Bering Sea. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, communities are gearing up to face the historic front.
There's no doubt that the low-pressure system charging across the Pacific Ocean right now is massive, and if it reaches its full potential...
Yeah, this could be the strongest storm to hit the Bering in possibly decades.
Dave Snyder is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage. He's basing that judgment on barometric pressure, which is expected to drop to record-breaking levels in the Bering Sea starting on Friday. As the pressure drops off, the winds will pick up to hurricane force. And without any land in the way to block them, the gusts will create large waves, up to 50 feet on the open ocean. Anywhere else, that would be unheard of. But in the Bering Sea...
Well, yeah, at this time of the year, it's pretty typical.
Some of the heaviest winds are expected in the western Aleutian Islands, stretching to the central part of the chain, where Adak sits. The former naval base could see gusts of up to 65 miles per hour on Friday and Saturday. Considering how many abandoned houses there are in Adak, city manager Leighton Lockett says his biggest concern is flying debris.
You know, there's a thoroughfare that runs by that housing. We're asking people to stay off that back road. Don't go surfing on the beach tomorrow or the weekend, you know, put the jet skis away.
The way Adak is situated could offer some shelter from the storm. And Lockett says he's already seen several fishing boats come into port and tie up. Crabbers have also been traveling back to Unalaska, where winds are only expected to reach about 50 miles per hour. That's exactly what Coast Guard Captain Joseph Deere was hoping for over the past week, as the agency put out warnings and advisories to the fishing fleet by radio.
We're seeing the fleet move east and south, or just slowing down and stopping to let this storm blow through.
Even large cargo ships are moving closer to shore, which should cut risk. Just in case, Deere says the Coast Guard has sent a helicopter to Unalaska to respond to any disasters. There's another on standby in Cold Bay and a cutter posted in the Bering Sea. While the Coast Guard's main focus is safety on the water, Deere says they may conduct a flyover in the Aleutians and Pribilofs after the storm passes.
We would go to some of the more remote areas and look and see what kind of shore erosion may call out on Channel 16 and... Just go out there and get kind of a firsthand view of what the storm may or may not have done along our coasts.
That's going to be a big concern for the Pribilof community of St. Paul. They'll see heavy winds and high seas of up to 25 feet, which could pound into the local harbor. The facility will probably shut down this weekend, according to Public Safety Director Mike Rover.
With the high waves coming in around the harbor, that we may have some low-lying areas that take a little bit more water than normal.
Rover's telling residents in St. Paul to stock up on supplies, tie down loose objects, and stay inside when the storm hits. But at the same time,
St. Paul is a very hardcore community. It's not the first storm they've weathered through.
And in all likelihood, it won't be the last. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
2 days after the election, both Alaska's Senate race and its gubernatorial race remain undecided, and both incumbents are lagging behind their challengers. Democratic Senator Mark Begich is down by 8,000 votes in his race against Republican Dan Sullivan, while Republican Governor Sean Parnell trails unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker by 3,000 votes. Neither candidate plans to concede at this point, and at least 20,000 votes still need to be counted next week. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez ran the numbers on both of those races and joins us to talk about the trends she's seeing. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So tell us a little bit about the model you're running.
So it's based entirely on district trends and nothing else. And I think that's a really important caveat that I just need to say off the bat. So last night, the Division of Elections released the number of uncounted absentee and early votes for each district. So knowing that, say, the MATSU votes more conservatively and Southeast tends to vote more liberally, what I ended up doing was taking the, you know, the percentage that the Democrats or independent candidate got and the percentage the Republican candidate got, and then basically running it through what we have left for absentee and early votes. It doesn't take into account that campaigns were specifically targeting people, and you might see some sort of party skew where, you know, we heard a lot about Senator Mark Begich's ground game in rural Alaska and the attempt to attract early voters there. So we don't know if there's a partisan lean in any direction because of this sort of campaigning. Also, you know, you have the military and they turn in early votes and they tend to vote more conservatively. So there are all of these factors that the model doesn't take into consideration. However, it would be pretty unusual for a district that tends to go more Republican to turn out a high level of Democratic absentee and early votes in contrast with the trend. This isn't going to be perfect by any stretch, but it kind of gives us a baseline, and it's the hardest data we really seem to have on this point as to how our races will turn out.
So if the district trends hold, what does it look like for the two candidates?
Well, in the gubernatorial race between unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker and Governor Sean Parnell, the incumbent Republican, Walker basically maintains his lead according to this model. He ends up growing his lead by, you know, about 100 votes. So really, it's just more of the same. And again, this isn't predicting the future. It's just how things look if they follow trend. It's worse news for Senator Begich. He's already 8,000 votes behind, and then running kind of his averages through this model, you actually see his Republican challenger, Dan Sullivan, increase his lead by another 1,000 votes. So he actually ends up going farther behind. His campaign has really stressed that they made a big absentee push, like I mentioned before. And we're not seeing all absentee ballots yet. Absentee in-person ballots, we have no idea how many there are of those. And we also don't know how many question ballots there will be. So basically, there are still a lot of things we don't know about this whole voting landscape.
What about on a district by district basis? What are you seeing there about how many, where the most uncounted ballots are?
So it's interesting looking at the differences between the gubernatorial race and the Senate race. When you look at which areas have the most uncounted ballots in the gubernatorial race, it looks like there's not really much of a partisan split in those districts. You know, the top district where we're seeing leftover early and absentee ballots is actually District 33, which covers downtown Juneau. And that is a serious Bill Walker and Mark Begich stronghold. Then we have District 29, which is on the Kenai Peninsula and covers Nikiski and Soldotna. And that's a big Governor Sean Parnell and Dan Sullivan stronghold. But the other top fives in the gubernatorial race really don't tilt for either candidate. So that it kind of makes sense that we're not seeing big changes in how these districts might vote according to these models. If you look at those same districts for the Senate race, there's a lot more of a partisan divide. So even though, you know, one of these top five districts might not have shown a preference in the governor's race, there's more of a tilt in favor of Republican candidate Dan Sullivan in those. There's one, take for example, District 9, that covers a good chunk of the Richardson Highway. In the gubernatorial race, you know, the spread is 2 points between Walker and Parnell. But if you look at it in the context of the Senate race, Dan Sullivan leads Mark Begich by 30 points. So you have a lot of people in that one region who were voting for Walker and then voting for Dan Sullivan, which some people might not have expected.
Alexandra Gutierrez is APRN's state government correspondent. You can find links to her research on Twitter at APRN. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a show that highlights contemporary art in Alaska.
When we say contemporary art in Alaska, it really means you live here and you're creating art and you can submit to the show.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
And by
Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
Former Anchorage School District teacher David Swantes was arraigned this afternoon in an Anchorage court. Swantes, age 73, is charged with 7 counts of sexual abuse of a minor. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Anchorage Police Detective John Vandervox says the arrest is based off an investigation of a complaint lodged by a former student who is now an adult who alleges Swantes molested him in the 1990s.
Many times in life, people, there are triggering events that bring these things forward, and in this case, it was one of those things for this particular person, and it came into the issue of trust and what to do with now their children and child care situations, and that's what triggered them and brought this case forward for us.
Swantes taught at Mount Spur Elementary School on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson from 1968 until 1993. Between 1993 and 96, he worked as a substitute teacher with the Anchorage School District. Then in 1999 and 2000, he worked in Title I after-school activities at Muldoon Elementary. Prior to working in the Anchorage School District, Swantes taught briefly in Southeast and rural Alaska. Detective Vandervox says there may be additional victims.
Whether or not people want to come forward after this many years, realize everybody and every victim deals with a situation in their own way. Some people may have put it behind them and it may be too difficult to deal with, and they may not want to come forward anymore. That's their own particular choice, and what we want to have come out of this is the best possible outcome for the victim.
APD is working with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations to identify other victims who may have attended Mount Spur Elementary in the past. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The National Collegiate Athletic Association has imposed penalties on the University of Alaska Fairbanks for student-athlete eligibility violations. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The NCAA imposed penalties are the result of violations involving 40 athletes on 9 UAF sports teams between 2007 and 2011. The penalties include a $30,000 fine, no 2014-15 postseason play for some teams, the short-term elimination of some scholarships, and the vacation of wins, points, and statistics of offending athletes and their teams. At a press conference Wednesday, UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers emphasized that the athletes are not to blame.
These infractions were the result of university errors and not due to wrongdoing by any of our student athletes.
The NCAA eligibility violations were self-reported by UAF in 2011 and 2012. Chancellor Rogers attributed them to the university failing to fully understand and identify issues for student athletes in 4 areas.
The eligibility of pre-majors, progress toward degree, declaration of major, and transfer credit requirements.
University officials did not pin blame for the violations on any individual staff. The university is required to publicize the infractions, and Vice Chancellor Mike Sfraga gave a blunt assessment of what happened.
It doesn't rest on one person or one department. There's multiple areas that we just didn't do a good job in. And we keep saying that often. I hope the message gets out that as an institution, we just didn't do our job well enough, and we failed our students.
Among the numerous NCAA penalties is a requirement that UAF develop a program to educate staff on eligibility certification and advising practices, something Athletic Director Gary Gray said the university has already implemented.
That has been in place now for quite some time. We continue to educate folks, and employees in the registrar's office, advising, et cetera. We meet with them monthly. We have a great process. It works. It's well documented. And I would hold it up as a model process. So we have completed that requirement.
UAF has also hired an academic advisor for student athletes and designated staff to manage their records. The NCAA is requiring the university to file an annual compliance report, including a review by an outside consultant. UAF is in the process of going over athletic statistics for the affected years to determine what team and individual athletic achievements will be vacated from the record books. UAF Media Relations Assistant Andrew Desrosiers confirms that Marius Courtauer's 2008 NCAA individual men's cross-country skiing title and the Nanuk Rifle Team 2007 and 2008 national championships will not be affected. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Election day is over and political signs are disappearing from yards and intersections, but where do they go? KSKA's Ann Hillman discovered some options.
Sitting outside of Central Recycling Services is a rusty blue dumpster with one lonely campaign sign inside. It's the beginning of the company's collection.
We see them all over and they litter the streets. We figured there's got to be a place for them instead of the landfill.
That's Nate Kruk with Central Recycling. He says people can drop off their old vinyl political signs for free. If he can collect about 4,000 pounds of them, the company will ship them off to be melted back into crude oil. But that's about 2,000 signs, depending on the size. Kruk says if they don't get enough, the signs can be reused instead as insulation for cabins or underneath flooring.
You put them underneath linoleum instead of some people use cardboard, some people use the special foam. And from what I've heard, these signs do a pretty good job.
Others use them to line their chicken coops because they're easy to hose off. The signs can also be turned into ramps for guinea pigs, spray painted to look like holiday decorations, or saved in case your candidate of choice ever runs again. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Anchorage Museum is set to open the All Alaska Juried Exhibition tomorrow, a show bringing together works of contemporary art from across the state. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, in its 48 years, the semi-annual exhibition has served as a showcase for new and evolving art in a state with a rich creative tradition.
Caroline Kozak organized this year's show, the 35th the museum has put on since its first All-Alaska Juried Exhibition back in 1966.
Really, the show started to showcase Alaskan artists and the work that's being made in the state and to provide a survey of the work that's currently being produced in a wide variety of media.
Defining contemporary art isn't easy, especially in Alaska. For a long time, fine arts with their roots back in Europe were considered better than native art, and the two were treated as separate schools. But in recent decades, there's been a push by galleries and art museums to collapse those boundaries, and Kozak says the exhibit submission rules are intentionally broad.
When we say contemporary art in Alaska, it really means you live here, and you're creating art, and you can submit to the show.
Kozak handled 600 submissions for the show, and then this year's jurist, Bonnie Lang Malcolmson of the Portland Art Museum, selected 40 for the exhibition, including this year's winner of the Juror's Choice Award, Anchorage's Cody Swanson.
So the two pieces that were accepted into this exhibition are pinhole photographs of landscapes that I took using a camera that I built from a cast of my head. So it's my head on top of a tripod.
Looking at Swanson's modified photos, you can't tell that they came from a self-constructed camera. He built the device to shift away from self-portraits, but still keep a part of himself and his imagination in the world he photographs. Framed on the gallery's walls, the pictures are moody gray landscapes, punctuated by fanciful, almost cartoonish ink sketches of objects that don't belong, like a Ferris wheel on the cold and windy nub of Beluga Point, or a wishful bridge out to Fire Island in Cook Inlet.
And the inspiration for this came partly from a 1989 report that I came across at work called Fire Island Crossing. It was a proposed bridge or causeway to Fire Island. And whenever I look at Fire Island, I always wish I could go over there.
Swanson's head camera pieces are about documenting the outside world with the distortions of memory and imagination. His mixed media works involve a nuanced approach to an old medium, film, inside a pinhole camera. But other artists in the show use materials like beads, smoked moose hide, beaver, and 55-gallon drums recast as video screens. Such diversity and range smashes the idea that there's any one flavor among the state's community of artists, showing off that Alaska and contemporary aren't contradictory terms when it comes to art. The juried exhibition opens tomorrow, and admission to the museum is free from 6 p.m. until 9 as part of the First Friday series. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A novel by first-time author Archana Mishra focuses on the need to make education more readily available for women. The Anchorage resident is a native of India and lived and worked in Australia before moving to Alaska. She says for rural women in India, indigenous people in Australia, and rural women in Alaska, the need is the same. Education creates equal societies. Mishra is an attorney and says all of the women in her family are highly educated. Her book, The Fortunate Child, follows a girl who dreams of changing the world through helping others. She says women can't be part of a thriving economy if they are not educational equals.
And I've seen that firsthand. I've worked with the indigenous community in back in Darwin, and I was working on the economic development for the indigenous community, and I kept shaking my head going, well, unless we make the education available to them, there's no point talking about the economic development for them. Then we moved to Alaska. It's the same thing. It's the rural population that's struggling for their basic amenity, and I think it's an obligation for the rest of the society if we want our native community to thrive and prosper. Education is the means to bring them at an equal level, to let them make those decisions and choices. So to me, what is the most surprising element of my book when I started writing? I had Indian community in mind. I had my own life back in India in mind. But as I started writing and as I started traveling and experiencing the world, it just seems to pervade all societies. Any community that you go to, education is the biggest weapon we have to make our societies more equal.
Did you have a thought about reading from the book for us?
Yeah, sure.
That would be great.
Renu was shaking with anger and gestured Rohini to sit down. They sat on a bench under the banyan tree. The giant tree had always soothed her before, but who knew what was destined that day? How would you react to know that my own father tried to violate me? I mean, sexually. Ha, huh. You've got some guts to lie, haven't you? Your father has told me everything, and he probably knew you might make up your own story about it one day. What do you mean by everything? It happened when I was away to see my sister, didn't it? Yes, and also, see, I told you I know everything. But how am I lying? You said he violated you, right? But he told me you crawled into his bed and started feeling his privates one night. He said he felt awkward and didn't know how to stop you. What the hell? Is that what he said happened? That is what happened. There is no other truth. Or you would rather be in denial. Whatever. So I take it as yes. You think I'm lying and you know the truth. Do you realize how living in a fantasy world has made you a perpetual liar? Come off it, Rohini, and be with us in reality. Everything will be fine. Trust me. There is no harm in accepting you made a mistake, even gross one like that. As far as we are all concerned, we have forgiven you.
Really a painful passage. Mm. And one, as you said, education is so universal. Mm. A story such as this one is also universal.
Yes.
And there's a lot of that being dealt with here in Alaska and, of course, across the world.
Mm.
How does that tie into this overarching theme of the need for education?
Yes. So one of the underlying theme in this book is violence against women. I would say violence against the weaker one. Men in general or people in power in general think that in order to subdue the other one, violence is a right mean to go about that, and they do that. And yes, violation of violent sexual attack against women is another perpetual theme, and what is so profound about that crime is that people do not hesitate to do it against their own people, against their own children, if that's what's going to fulfill their desire. giving them education, again, is a powerful tool because it helps them think, it helps them understand their own potential, their own strength, and then their own rights when they're violated. Because it's very easy for a child to complain to their mother or their family about something that happened against them and being snubbed. But as long as we are aware that these are our rights and we have the informed choices to make, we'll be able to break those barriers. Women, in most cases, who have stopped their children from going forward and talking about their violations have been the ones who felt less empowered at that time, who felt that they are not educated enough, they are not empowered enough to leave that family and take their child away from that danger, have often made those choices to be silent. And I think, and I'm of a firm opinion that if the woman in this case was educated, if she had the means to look after herself, she would have made different choices.
What are you hoping that people will come away with when they read this book?
First of all, I wanted to get this message very loud and clear that education is the weapon to bring equality to your society. If your dream is to have more equal, more fair society, invest your time, invest your energy and your focus in bringing education to everybody, regardless of who they are, where they come from. That's one. The other one is we all have our own set of prejudice and bias through which we see the world. Simple things. I have been to many parts of the world, and frankly, I have never been treated as unequally by anyone. I never felt like people are showing their prejudice because I believe in the fact that if you are prejudiced against me for some reason, it's your problem, not mine. As long as your prejudice is not demonstrated in your behavior, that affects me adversely. So feel empowered. Be confident in yourself that you have your own identity and your beliefs. As long as they are valued beliefs and they're fair belief, keep doing your work. And helping someone through education, to me, is the most noble thing we can do as human beings. It's easier than we think, and it's more powerful than we think.
Archana Mishra's new book, The Fortunate Child, follows a young girl who dreams of educational equality and overcoming her own personal tragedy. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of our stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.